Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters. Ian is in Australia for the premiere of a film he made for the BBC in 1968 that was shown once but then destroyed because it was considered too controversial. Fortunately, the director of the film recently discovered a print, and the documentary was reconstructed by the ABC in Australia. It'll be shown for the first time in 45 years at the Sydney Opera House on Thursday night. As for what we're going to do today, well, the budget and deficit crises in DC are on all our minds. Their local, national and international impact make for both water cooler chat and news headlines. Today we're joined by The Nation magazine's Ari Berman and University of California Riverside political scientist Martin Johnson to puzzle this catastrophe out. And then we turn to a wider focus than the Republican Party and a wilier fox than the Republican Party, namely Putin and his Russia. What gives? We talk to Daniel Treisman from the University of California, Los Angeles. Joining us now is Ari Berman, a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He's written extensively about U.S. politics, foreign policy, and the grubby intersection of money and politics. Ari is the author of the book Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. And his latest article for The Nation is The GOP's White Southern Republican Problem. Welcome to the program, Ari Berman.
Hi, Toby. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. So, in a nutshell, what is the GOP's White Southern Republican Problem, other than a bunch of people who are stopping us from doing anything?
Well, I think it's the title kind of explains itself, but the problem is that the Republican Party over time has become much more Southern, much more white, and much more conservative. And that's a problem because it's pushing the party to the right in Congress to the point where they are really controlled by the extreme elements of their caucus that are heavily descended from the Southern states. So, for example, after the 1994 election, there were 69 Southern Republicans out of 233 members of the GOP House. Now there are 96 white Southerners, actually, I should say 98 white Southerners who are members of the House. So the number of white conservative Southerners in the Republican caucus has increased in only two decades from 69 members to 98 members, and that's a pretty significant shift.
But if we go back 50 years, if my history serves me adequately, when Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the civil rights legislation that included voting acts and so on, he basically did so saying words to the effect of, well, this is goodbye to the Democratic majority in Congress, didn't he?
He did say that. He said it actually, yeah, after he signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, he basically said, I've lost the South for a generation. Now, it may be that he's lost the South for a few generations. but it's interesting, you know, within the Democratic Party, there was a split between, you know, Southern conservatives and Northern liberals. And to some extent within the Republican Party, we also saw a similar split between Southern conservatives and some more Northern liberal elements. What's striking about what's happening right now, though, in the Republican Party is those Northern moderates have basically been eliminated. The fight within the Republican Party is often a fight between two sets of conservatives, more pragmatic conservatives and more extreme conservatives, the Tea Party wing of the caucus, who are overwhelmingly represented from the South. It's not like there's a fight between conservatives and moderates anymore because there are very few moderates left. So that's what we're seeing with the shutdown fight, for example, is it's basically conservatives arguing among themselves.
So if we take John Boehner's situation, he is the Speaker of the House. If he were doing that job in some other countries, he'd just round them up and threaten them. Why isn't he doing that?
Because I think he's worried that if he threatens them, they're going to threaten him, meaning that if he holds a vote where he loses a large number of his caucus and instead relies on a large number of Democrats to pass anything, which increasingly seems like that's what's going to happen, then he's going to lose his job because the quote-unquote suicide caucus in the House of Representatives, the 80 House members who told him that he better defund Obamacare or else – if he doesn't have their support and there's a vote in terms of who the leadership should be, there's a real feeling that Boehner could lose. He narrowly survived one of these coups already, and there's a feeling that it's really the rank-and-file membership that's controlling the party and not the leadership this time around.
That's very interesting. So in terms of what was always assumed to be the checks and balances of a separation of powers in the operation of our constitution, that doesn't really work if you play this kind of ideological politics, does it? Instead, you want supposedly the kind of relationship that Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan had, no?
Well, I think people thought that the separation of powers would keep the different branches of government honest. I don't think they thought that there would be hostage taking every 3 months when it comes to funding the government. I don't think that's the kind of checks and balances that people have envisioned when they drafted the Constitution. One of the things that's striking here is that because of the anarchy in the House, basically the failure to pass anything, the most routine of budgets, for example, and then because of the filibuster in the Senate, the requirement that you need really 67 votes to do certain things and 60 votes to do pretty much anything, it means that really it's virtually impossible to do anything in Congress right now. And that's why President Obama has been having so much trouble, because Republicans know this is where their best leverage is, and they're not willing to do anything without just an enormous fight. So once you think something is resolved, for example, you think like in 2011 we get a deal on the debt ceiling, or 2012 we get a deal on the budget. You think it's resolved, and then what just happens is a year later the whole thing repeats itself, but in an even more dysfunctional and disturbing way.
Right. Now, with the class of 94 that came in and the Gingrich Revolution, they had their disastrous comeuppance in their attempt to shut down the government, and Bill Clinton romping to victory in the next presidential election, and the Democrats doing quite well in the 98 midterms. That civilized or controlled or domesticated or did something to these people, at least to some of that cohort. Given the gerrymander that appears to exist after the redistricting of 2010, is there any electoral discipline that could possibly apply to these people nowadays?
Well, it's a very good point that you made up, because I think Republicans are really emboldened by the redistricting, because what they did as soon as they won power in 2010 in all these states is they drew the maps to their advantage so that they really wouldn't be under threat for basically a decade until the districts have to be drawn again when the next census comes out. You have a situation, particularly in the South, where conservatives are overwhelmingly representing these extremely white conservative districts. So they're worried first and foremost about a primary challenge. That's how they could lose the election. There's a very small chance that they could lose a general election to a Democrat because of the way these districts are drawn. So that's pushing politics to the right for sure. What's also happening is that it's just a lot more difficult to take over the House now than it used to be. There's a lot less fluidity in politics because of where people live and because of gerrymandering. So, for example, in the last election, Democrats got 1.5 million more votes in the House of Representatives, but Republicans had a 33-seat majority. And that basically means that for Democrats to take over the House, they need to win millions of more votes than Republicans, because Republicans are already disproportionately represented in rural areas in the House of Representatives. Democrats increasingly live in cities to begin with. And so you have this situation where, because of both of the population patterns and because of how the lines have been gerrymandered, you just need an enormous wave to be able to wipe out the Republicans. And I'm not sure in 2014 we're going to see that wave. There's certainly a lot of anger among people at the Republican Party, but the question is, will it play out in these specific congressional districts? And I'm not sure about that.
It might just mean bigger majorities for Democrats in safe seats.
Exactly. That's the problem. The question is, are the people who are outraged about the shutdown, are they living in these hard-right Republican districts, or are they living in swing districts of which there are very few, or are they living in already Democratic districts? And that's really the problem here. You have to really go down to the most minute level to try to figure out who's at stake. And I mean, I think Republicans on a national level are worried. I think Senate candidates are worried. I think 2016 candidates are worried about what's going on. I think certain Republican members, obviously the Republican members who represent states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, swing states, they're concerned. Republicans in Georgia, in Kentucky, in Mississippi, are they concerned about this? I don't think nearly as much.
I'm speaking with Ari Berman. Ari is a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. So, Ari, if you were advising the Democrats right now, God forbid you had to, what would you tell them to do?
Well, number one, I would say focus on those states where there's swing districts that still remain. For example, the Philadelphia suburbs. You've got maybe three or four Republicans representing seats in and around the Philadelphia suburbs. So, I mean, those kind of people are clear targets in the House of Representatives. I think you can get them. I also think this is a big issue in certain kind of borderline Senate races. So the GOP has to win races in places like North Carolina, for example, to be able to take back the Senate. I don't think the shutdown's playing very well in those kind of states. And then I think nationally, just heading towards 2016, I mean, you really have to kind of put pressure on the Chris Christies of the world, who are kind of in a no-win situation right now. If the more moderate establishment elements of the Republican Party, if they denounce the Tea Party, then they have a big target on their back going in to the primary. But if they sort of back the shutdown strategy, if they side with the Ted Cruz wing of the party, then they're just in extreme amounts of trouble when it comes to getting themselves in any kind of position for a general election. And so I think this is really, the whole thing is really hurting all elements of the Republican Party. I think that's why the president, although he dislikes the shutdown and it's hurting a lot of people, I think he's willing to wait here because he knows that, you know, it's the other party that's getting the flack. The only bad thing for the Democrats now is that we're having a fight about Obamacare and the rollout is going so badly for them that they're not really able to capitalize as much as they can.
Speaking of Obamacare, how relevant really is that? And what is it about the idea of essentially a mild intervention in health insurance that so irks Republicans who appear to be quite happy, most of them, to receive or to potentially receive Medicaid and Medicare?
Well, that kind of hypocrisy has been going on for a long time. I mean, you had, for example, the Southern conservatives in the 1950s and 60s who were just receiving an enormous amount of subsidies from the federal government. They were the ones most vociferously denouncing Medicare when it first happened. So, I mean, you can pretty much draw a straight line from the kind of people that were denouncing Medicare and the kind of people who are denouncing Obamacare. The point I was making about Obamacare was just that the rollout of it, the actual implementation of it, doesn't seem to be going that well, with people having problems with the website. And I think that is, to some extent, undercutting the momentum that the Democrats and Obama would have right now. If millions of people were signing up for Obamacare at the very moment that Republicans were trying to defund Obamacare, there would be a great contrast that the president could draw. Right now, he can basically say it's crazy to shut down the government for Obamacare, but he can't make the argument, not quite as effectively, not yet at least, that Obamacare is something that's going to benefit millions of people. I think he will be able to make that argument once the kinks get out of the program, but I do think to some extent the rollout has been less impressive than I think supporters of the law were hoping for.
Oh, no question. But similar things happened in a somewhat pre-computer age with the mid-60s medical reforms. And I guess some of that's inevitable, but I take your point.
You know how people are with instant gratification today. I mean, you know, you expect everything to work smoothly, and you particularly expect, you know, anything on the internet to work right away. And so I think it is frustrating for people. Obviously, the people that are going on to enroll really also need the health care. So I think the quicker this can get worked out, the better. But in some ways, this has been a blessing for Obama because the shutdown has really overshadowed a lot of the problems in Obamacare. So the GOP in some ways has done him a favor.
Yeah, absolutely. I wondered if I could pick you up on an earlier point you made, Ari, that interests me a lot, which is that essentially we're seeing two Americas constructed out of the two political parties. One is urban. It's either educated or working class, and it's multicultural. And the other is rural. It's generally not very educated, and it's not very multicultural. Have I got that right?
No, I mean, that's absolutely correct. And that's a trend that's really increasing. I mean, it used to have, for example, Republicans representing places like New York, you know, places like New York City even, which for many years had, you know, Republican mayor or it had Republican senators. And now you look at places like New York City, states like New York, I mean, they're just much more Democratic. At the same time, you used to have, you know, white, relatively conservative Democrats representing states like Texas, representing states across the South. They are now extinct. And so the extinction of both Southern white Democrats and the extinction of liberal Northern Republicans has basically meant that you can pretty much look at a map, put a pin in it, and figure out who's representing that district. Because except in, you know, the most conservative states, the cities are represented by Democrats. And by and large, the rural areas are represented by Republicans. There are some places where that's not true. But we do seem to be concentrating by geographic lines. And if you just look, for example, at where people want to live, I mean, you know, the Democrats want to live in cities. And that's what's happening in this country. And Republicans are in rural America, they're dying out, but they have a disproportionate influence in American politics, both because of the structure of the U.S. Senate, with every state getting the same amount of seats, and also because of the way districts are drawn in the House, which disproportionately gives a lot of power to rural constituents.
Now, what about the argument that this country is becoming more cosmopolitan, more international, more Latino, and that all of that is going to play out finally in the Democrats' favor? Because after all, Latinos, Mexicans, Central Americans are nowadays really throughout the country. They're not just in the big cities. In the last 5 or 10 years, they're in little towns in Illinois, for example, aren't they? And once those folks become, in a sense, normalized or legalized or whatever terms we use, they become potential political actors in ways that may be quite inimical to the Republican majorities in some of those regions.
I think we're still a ways from getting there. We're a ways from getting there because there's not enough of them. The demographics aren't high enough. You mentioned immigration reform. I think one reason that Republicans are so opposed to immigration reform is just for the reason that you outlined. They're worried that once these people that are here illegally, once they become citizens, they're going to vote Democratic. And I think for good reason, given the rhetoric and the policies that Republicans are proposing. And so, and I think there's some opposition to immigration reform just because they don't want to create, you know, 7 to 11 million new Democratic voters. So, I think we're ways down the road here. There's been a lot of talk about how demographic change, particularly by Latinos, will transform the American electorate, will turn states like Texas blue. But I still see it as something that's 10, 20, even in some places 30 years down the road. I think it's having an impact, though, on presidential elections, because you look at states, for example, like Colorado, like Nevada, like Florida. These are places that are now much more competitive and they're trending blue because of the Hispanic growth. So I think it's a big impact on national politics. In terms of local congressional seats in red states, I still think it's a little ways away.
Ari Berman, we've asked you to look into your crystal ball 30 years ahead. What about your crystal ball for the next few days? What on earth is going to happen?
Well, it looks like there's going to be a deal. It seems like there's going to be a deal in the Senate, and then that's going to get brought to the House. I think the leadership just had enough They don't think they can sustain this for another week or two. There's just too much bad press happening. I think they realize that they're not going to get a whole lot of concessions out of Obama. I think that the best bet they think is to fund the government for a while and hope that they can suck Obama back into grand bargain territory. Clearly, the president has a soft spot for doing this kind of deal. I'm not really sure why he's so intent on doing it, but he's on numerous occasions offered Republicans pretty good deals that would, for example, offer cuts to things like Medicare and Social Security. I always thought that those were huge concessions by the president. The GOP would be crazy not to take them. Now maybe Republicans realize that they're in such a situation that they will take these places because they can't negotiate for anything better. So I think the hope is fund the government in the short term, use whatever little leverage they have to get some sort of long-term deal that's more beneficial to their cause, but I don't think they can sustain this for too many more weeks.
And on the Obama side, that means there are two legacies. One is Obamacare, the other is Iran speak. Is that right? And not much else.
Well, I don't know. I think it's complicated. I mean, you know, you can look at Obama and you can say there's all these things he could have done, but then you look at the other side and how crazy they are and you realize how much worse it could be. So it could be a lot worse. It's not necessarily the best bumper sticker, but I think this is certainly true.
Thank you very much, Ari Berman. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks, Toby. I appreciate it.
I was speaking with Ari Berman, a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He's written extensively about U.S. politics, foreign policy, and the always grubby intersection of money and politics. He's the author of the book Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. His latest article for The Nation is The GOP's White Southern Republican Problem. We're going to take a break for station identification now, then we'll be joined by Martin Johnson for further discussion of the shutdown in D.C. Martin Johnson, a professor at the University of California, Riverside.
I wish I was in the land of cotton. Old times there are not. We gotta look away, look away, look away.
Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Joining us now is Martin Johnson, a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of California, Riverside, and director of the university's impressive-sounding Media and Communications Research Lab. Martin studies media politics, political communication, public opinion, and political behavior in the U.S. He's co-author with Kevin Arsenault of Changing Minds or Changing Channels, Partisan News in an Age of Choice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Martin Johnson.
Thanks for having me.
Are you in the lab, even as we speak?
I am not in the lab right now. I'm in my office right now.
Okay. So I hope at some point you'll tell us what goes on in the lab and maybe even take us down and show us what's on the slab.
Sure.
But before that, I wanted to ask you about what on earth is going on. We've been speaking with Ari Berman about the Republicans and the shutdown and so on. And I wanted to carry on that conversation with you, but focus particularly on media issues and public opinion. What is the way in which, or how would you describe the way in which the various fractions of our media system, our media industry, are covering the budget and deficit crises?
Well, you know, we've got this really fragmented media audience. So you've got people out there who want to watch news from a conservative perspective, want to watch news from a liberal perspective, and then, you know, lots of other people who, you know, just, you know, either want to watch news or don't. And so we've got all these different perspectives represented in the content that you're seeing, and it in the case of the shutdown, it makes it I think, kind of really difficult to figure out exactly what's going on. In the mainstream media, which, you know, if you think about, you know, the traditional broadcast networks like ABC, NBC, and CBS, to a certain extent CNN, you know, there's this ongoing, you know, kind of persistent commitment to the objectivity norm, the kind of performed objectivity, where if you have a comment from a Democrat on the shutdown, you've got to have a comment from a Republican, and preferably one that, you know, contradicts or quote balances whatever perspective is being represented. So you see a lot of coverage like this. I was just looking at a headline from I think CBS that, you know, carefully had both Reid's name and McConnell's name in the headline, you know, and so you see this kind of he said, she said kind of coverage that, you know, that we're all used to by now.
Well, I notice that they don't do their comb-overs or choose their clothing without calling one another up before any photo opportunity. They've become the same person, Tweedledum and Tweedledee.
Well, I think you know, there is this very broadly accepted set of norms that, you know, it's how students in journalism schools are trained to you know, perform the subjectivity of, you know, source one, source two from different perspectives, and then, you know, you've got a balanced story. So yeah, I mean, I think it's been that way for quite some time. Then you have breaking from the pack, in a sense, the new partisan media. So think about here, MSNBC on the left and Fox on the right, and then some perhaps. And you get different perspectives, entirely different perspectives, from them. On Fox News, one of the things that's interesting to me is watching, the strong commitment to, simultaneously minimizing the shutdown, to sort of, other kinds of exaggerated claims. It's a very complicated story you get out of the Fox Newses of the world. There, the federal government shutdown is a story about the budget. It's often hard to find the word shutdown used. It's budget negotiations or budget. You might see stalemate. If you ever see the word shutdown, it's often modified by, you know, a word like partial shutdown, or you know, so there's this sort of persistent minimization on Fox. Simultaneously, a set of claims about the Obama administration, in particular, exaggerating the effects of the shutdown and politicizing the shutdown. You saw this over the weekend with you know, protests at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., and over the last week or so, states contributing money to reopen national parks, and you know, and a lot of claims on the right that did percolate up into Fox News that what was going on in Washington and in the Obama administration was, you know, sort of purposefully closing parks and purposefully closing park service sites, you know, as a political tool in the ongoing government shutdown. So you see those kinds of claims as well. On the left, there's a broad recognition that there's a shutdown. I mean, MSNBC regularly covers the shutdown, as well as what kinds of particular programs, people, problems are motivated by a lack of a budget, a lack of a government resource.
If we move away, Martin Johnson, from the electronic bourgeois media and par excellence, on the one hand, the classic television broadcast networks, on the other, the newer partisan news cable networks, and we look at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and their equivalents in different cities around the country, are we seeing any patterns in coverage there?
I mean, again, I think those kind of tend to focus on the sort of battle between the Democrats and the Republicans. And one of the criticisms that you've seen, or that we've seen, of this, again, objective journalism, is that in many ways, sort of missing the story about the internal fight in the Republican Party. You see it talked about, but this is an element of nuance that's really important. A lot of what's going on here is there's a fight between factions in the Republican Party, and an effort of a Republican leader to stay in control of it all. But even these mainstream outlets, very thoughtful newspapers, kind of revert to that Democrats versus Republicans, Reid versus McConnell, Obama versus Boehner kind of coverage.
Why are they missing that key story that Boehner is out of control in the sense that he cannot control the crazies? Why are the media not covering that story?
Well, it's funny. There's an interesting thing going on, I think, and that is it is getting covered. But it's getting covered in a peculiar way. It's getting covered as criticism of media coverage.
Like we're doing now.
Like we're doing now, exactly. So people are talking about this story, but they're talking about its lack of emphasis in the coverage. A couple of things. Number one, it is really complicated. And even as... In print media, you have a lot more space and time to be thoughtful and consider things. But at the same time, it will be a simplification of these events. So the complexity of this, might be difficult to cover. Another reason is that I think Republicans in particular, and you see this on Fox News, are kind of trying to treat this as a left talking point. That in fact, it really is about the intransigence of President Obama, who's bullying members of Congress to accept Obamacare. It's not about an internal fight in the Republican Party of the right versus the far right. There's this reaction to, if that's a left talking point, then we're going to have to balance that with something else. So you end up with debating whether or not this is the story. And over the weekend, we saw Carl Bernstein talking about it. Maybe a week ago, there was a piece in Al Jazeera on their website that was, kind of considering this. So those kinds of events have led to these sort of second stories about whether or not this really is the story.
I'm speaking with Martin Johnson, who's a professor in political science and director of the Media and Communication Research Lab at the University of California, Riverside. Martin, what about those aspects of the media that are rather touchingly sometimes called social media? In your lab, are you subdividing them as well?
We're not studying much social media right now. So by this you mean Twitter and Facebook and that sort of thing. What we have tended to focus on in the lab are the effects of partisan media as sort of the first wave of studies that we've done. And there, what we're really interested in trying to figure out is to what extent do we need to be concerned about, say, conservative media making unsuspecting people more conservative and liberal media making people who are unsuspecting of its intent more liberal. And so or is it the case that people are sort of thoughtfully sorting themselves into kinds of things they watch? And our evidence tends to suggest that when a conservative picks up the remote control, they're already conservative, they want to watch conservative news if they want to watch news, and they turn on something like Fox, rather than what I think a lot of people are concerned about, which is this idea that someone who doesn't have a set up well-informed political orientations, picks up the remote and stumbles onto Fox News and is made into a conservative. It's really more people who already adopt a left or right, strong left or right perspective and already actually quite know a lot about news events and public affairs are selecting a tone or selecting what they want to watch. So the polarization that's happening as a function of this kind of media is kind of polarization that exists prior to the content itself.
What you're talking about is really advertising executive heaven. In other words, it's right. a way in which
I'm able to stratify and fragment this audience and find exactly my consumers that I want to, you know, provide products to and messages. Absolutely.
What about people, Martin Johnson, who turn on the television or the radio or open their newspaper or their website? They might be socialists, they might be capitalists, they might be in between, but they're ready to be persuaded by facts and reason and theory. What's happening with them?
Well, I think folks like that are, you know, are pretty diverse in their news consumption. I mean, I would say rare. A lot of people that are curious kind of already have perspectives and may not generally be looking for persuasion. They might be looking for information, but they're not looking to change. You know, the committed socialist isn't looking to be persuaded, you know, to why they've, you know, got their views on the economy completely wrong. A person who you know, maybe doesn't have that kind of political perspective, that hasn't, you know, really necessarily spent a lot of time thinking about structures of markets and alternatives and things like that. You know, frankly, most of those folks just aren't watching news. I mean, this is part of the problem of the contemporary media environment with its diversity and fragmentation. It's wonderful to have choice, but we lack a sense of this, what some people have called the inadvertent audience, the people who do just stumble onto news and public affairs programming. It's just so easy for me to turn on if I don't want to watch coverage of the shutdown. It's just so easy for me to turn on and watch, you know, Duck Dynasty or Hillbilly Handfishing or Honey Boo Boo or whatever, you know, some new reality show. It's just so easy for me to distract myself from all of the above.
Now, Martin, we're speaking about public opinion here and its complexities. In terms of the polling that we're seeing at the moment, many people are interpreting the current conjuncture as potentially disastrous for the Republicans. What's your perspective?
Well, that does seem to be the case. You know, the polling that we're seeing, you know, these dramatic numbers of the Republican Party being viewed as disfavorably as it ever has been, if not worse than it ever has been. You know, there's a meaningful way in which the Republicans are losing the shutdown politically. I mean, it's just so bad for the country. It seems weird to talk about it in these terms, but there is a political sense in which the Republicans are losing this public fight with the public. Now, the question is, what does that mean for the next set of elections? And, you know, it's possible that it doesn't mean that much, that we'll just buy, you know, by the time we get to the next set of elections, we'll have moved on to the next public controversy, and, you know, and it remains to be seen what kind of memory this has.
The other issue which we were discussing with Ari Berman is the fact that there are so few unsafe seats in Congress, other than when it comes to internal struggles over pre-selection. There are so few swing seats, and particularly in the white southern hegemony of the Republican Party, there is gerrymandering to a very extreme level.
Yeah, I mean, you've got all kinds of things going on, but you do have this core of, you know, sort of Tea Party seats that are, you know, dominated by rural, you know, Anglo voters that, you know, that are probably going to return, if not their current Tea Party member, maybe somebody slightly, I hate to say slightly to the left, but slightly to the left of their Tea Party member, but still pretty conservative to Congress. And so, you know, this sort of set of entrenched fights, you know, I think shows little sign of abatement.
Now, in terms of the possibility of alternative voices to spice up our media diet, it seems to me we get the journalists and we get the politicos, but then many of the other commentators we hear from are think tankers. They're people from a DC think tank that is on the right, and they're marshaled up against somebody from the left. I'm very rarely seeing people like yourself, independent but academics involved. What's the story there? Why are U.S. political scientists so bad at getting on television?
Because <Great question. laughs> I can't remember the last time I was on television, but I'm not trying to be on television. I mean, I think part of it might be Not that many political scientists, seek that kind of attention, but that might be changing. I mean, in fact, I would say it has been changing substantially over the last even 5 years. I mean, so, you know, we have Melissa Harris Perry, a few political scientists out there in very, very public roles. In fact, Rachel Maddow, I think we claim as well, or some of us claim, she's a PhD in political science. So, there are a few, and there are efforts underway to I think be more engaging and engaged. There are, for example, blogs like if you haven't ever read the Monkey Cage, which was started by a group of political scientists, still a group of political scientists, and recently acquired by the Washington Post, so even more visible than it has been. And there are similar kind of efforts. That Monkey Cage is a blog that focuses on American politics, elections, and sometimes you see some interesting sort of international affairs and comparative politics. But another blog called The Duck of Minerva is a really interesting blog that is run by a group of international relations scholars. And so, there are efforts like this, I think, to, like I say, be more engaging and engaged. Yet another is called The Mischiefs of Faction that recently started up. And I think we'll see more of this and certainly welcome it.
Does the Duck of Minerva get up and go to bed earlier or later than the Owl of Minerva?
I have no idea. My guess is they stay up around the clock. I think they're all over the globe, so the sun never sets on the Duck of Minerva.
Let me ask you about this international question that you've raised, Martin. In the media that I've been listening to, reading, watching, not all of which are US-based, there's a lot of discussion about the US falling into, in a sense, intellectual disrepute as a consequence of Republican Party antics, and a lot of discussion of the possibility of the dollar seeking to be the world's reserve currency at some point in the future if there are more of these shenanigans when it comes to the debt ceiling. How much are those international questions playing out, would you say, in the media coverage of the struggle that we're undergoing at present?
Well, I think you see, comparatively little of those questions raised in the coverage of this. I think primarily the focus is the focus of this coverage is on domestic programs and domestic political conflict. I do think, however, a lot of serious people, on the left and the right, are really worried about the exactly what you're describing, the intransigence leading to instability internationally, both in terms of for the U.S. as well as rippling through other economies. Insecurity, the way global economics works, deep insecurity anywhere is deep insecurity everywhere eventually. So it's certainly of concern, I think. And so you see that percolate through occasionally, but the preoccupation is on those domestic issues.
And that's one of the things I've always felt was a weak spot, both in U.S. politics and in media coverage thereof. So remorselessly, relentlessly domestic, when the implications for the rest of the world are often quite extreme, but the international repercussions for us back here are extensive as well.
Absolutely. Part of it, again, goes back to this training issue that I was hinting at. I think some journalism schools are good at that, but others aren't. And, journalists, are often in the United States looking for the story close to home. And the closer to home, if I can find the thing in my community that's been affected by the shutdown and write a story about it, if I'm, at one of these sort of, local newspapers, that's what I'm going to focus on.
Martin Johnson, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Martin Johnson is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of California, Riverside, and director of its Media and Communications Research Lab. Martin studies media politics, political communication, public opinion, and political behavior in the U.S. He is co-author with Kevin Arsenault of Changing Minds or Changing Channels, Partisan News in an Age of Choice. We'll take a break now for station identification, and following that we'll be joined by Daniel Treisman, a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, to discuss the current political and economic situation in Putin's Russia. I'm joined now by Daniel Treisman, who is a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, a specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia, a recipient of fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and the Hoover Institution. He's the author of two acclaimed books on Russia, and his newest is Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Treisman.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you a basic threshold question that's been puzzling me as somebody who's been thinking about the Soviet Union and Russia since probably before you were born. Namely, what is the difference in terms of foreign policy and authoritarianism between the Kremlin in, say, 1969 and the Kremlin today?
Well, of course, the Kremlin in 1969 made no pretense of being democratic. It, of course, had elections and it claimed to be a democracy, a people's democracy, but it made far less effort than the regimes we see in Russia since 1991 to go through the motions of democratic politics. Now, I would say at present, Russia under President Putin is a relatively soft authoritarian state. Some people would say it's a hybrid regime with some features of democracy, some of autocracy, mixed together in a rather strange combination. But in terms of foreign policy, there are some things which were distinctively Soviet, supporting Marxist revolutions around the world. Russia no longer does that. But there are some things which are really tied to Russia's national interest, or then the Soviet national interest. And I think it's to be expected that there'll be a certain amount of disagreement between the great power that is centered in Moscow and the superpower that is centered in Washington.
Well, let's move on to that topic, if we could, Daniel. Specifically, the nature of U.S.-Russian relations today versus in the past. In the early 1990s, we were very triumphant here. We'd won the Cold War. They were in full retreat and so on. One senses a desire to, in a sense, bring back the Russian bear to its full glory.
Well, I think perhaps in some earlier years there was a certain amount of this resentment, desire to get respect from the West. I think really these days, although Putin sometimes speaks in a way which is somewhat anti-American, at the same time, I think the Russian foreign policy is quite pragmatic. And in fact, it's driven by interests, which sometimes don't overlap with U.S. interests. I think Russia is going through a difficult period at the moment. Its economic growth is decreasing. It has to try to craft a new economic strategy to take it beyond the current situation of heavy dependence on natural resources, oil and gas. And at the same time, Putin has come under real pressure from opposition, which would like a more open liberal political system. So I don't see Russia today as being particularly assertive, although it is always quick to make clear its disagreements with Western policies.
So a big issue for them is how do they add value to their economy in a manufacturing way or a services way, as opposed to living from quarrying and mining, because that's not the way to build an economy, sometimes called the Dutch disease. And secondly, what do they do about a fairly restive civil society? Now, just popping onto that topic for a moment, Daniel Treisman, I'm very interested in and very concerned about, as will be many of our listeners, what's happened with the Pussy Riot affair and also the Greenpeace 30 or the Arctic 30. Let's look at Greenpeace first. That does relate to this whole resources diplomacy issue, doesn't it?
Yes, and it really brings into clear focus an element of cultural difference between Russia and Western Europe and also the U.S. to some extent. I would say culturally, Russia is really quite similar to various Western countries about 30 years ago. So if we look at attitudes towards the environment, towards homosexuality, towards religion and various other subjects, Russia is very much a kind of traditional conservative society like various Western European countries about 30 years ago, and definitely like the U.S. in some regards. The West has really developed in a very interesting way in the last 30 years, and Russia perhaps will catch up to it. But at the moment, what the Russian leaders dismissively refer to as political correctness is really at odds with the way that I think still most people in Russia think.
I'm speaking with Daniel Treisman, a professor of political science at UCLA, and his latest book is called Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. And thinking about Pussy Riot, a more indigenous local phenomenon than Greenpeace, is this again a case of women should be seen and not heard, and Russia being caught in a kind of old-school politics and not really alive to the cultural politics of the vibrant civil societies we've seen in the last three decades?
I don't really think it's about women and women should be seen and not heard. It's more about opponents of the government should be polite and people should not violate the sanctity of the Orthodox Church. But at the same time, I think it's far less about some deep values than about opportunistic politics on the part of the Kremlin. Putin facing unprecedented public demonstrations in the end of 2011, beginning of 2012, demonstrations that were really focused in the cities and in the most modernized, most internationalized stratum of society. Putin really wanted to try and isolate this urban danger, this new postmodern class from the heartland of Russia, which is where Putin thinks that his solid base of support lies. And he chose to do that in part through waging a culture war or a cultural war. And it really served his purposes to emphasize the Pussy Riot issue and as well as to emphasize gay rights campaigns, which were very small in Russia at the time, in order to make the ordinary, fairly conservative Russians in the provinces feel very distant from these protesters in the cities, to really emphasize to claim that the goals of the protesters in the cities were to impose a kind of West European-style postmodern society and lifestyle on Russia, rather than to, I would say, more honestly portray the protesters as being primarily motivated by a desire for less corruption and more democratic freedom.
So, Daniel Treisman, if you were offering advice to Pussy Riot or Greenpeace in managing their situations, what would it be?
Well, it depends on their goals. I think Pussy Riot, the whole Pussy Riot affair could have been managed and made to go away quite quickly if the the girls of Pussy Riot were perhaps less brave and less determined and had reversed themselves, apologized, I think it could have been negotiated away. But they really believed in what they had said and what they were doing. They stood up for these positions, and I think in the end they were used by the Kremlin to make this political point to the mainstream of Russian society. At the same time, I think they have changed Russian society somewhat. There are debates going on within Russia that simply weren't taking place before the Pussy Riot case. So they have had an impact, but I don't think it's my place to advise them on what to do. It's really for them to think, what their goals are, and I'm sure they're capable of pursuing them in an effective way.
Fair enough. If you've got time, one quick question about Syria.
Okay.
Many people are depicting Russia's role in the Syrian diplomacy of the last few weeks as a triumphant one, by contrast with the United States, France, and so on. What's your take?
Well, I actually was at a meeting where Putin spoke about 3 weeks ago, and he was given the opportunity to gloat over the chemical weapons management plan that he had come up with. And he chose not to gloat. He said, he was asked by a journalist, doesn't this help Obama to save face? And Putin replied, this isn't about saving face. It's just that Russian and American interests coincided on this. And we're both eager to make this work, or words to that effect. So I think the Russians don't see this as being about scoring points or anything like that. It simply happened that both Russia and the U.S. saw some way to advance their own interests. It's definitely in the Russian interest not to have a vast chemical weapons arsenal in Syria. And, of course, it was in the U.S. Interest at that point, and also in President Obama's interest to find a way out of the very complicated situation that had emerged at that point.
Daniel Treisman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters. We were speaking with Daniel Treisman, Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia, a recipient of fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and the Hoover Institution. He's the author of two acclaimed books on Russia, and his latest is called Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller, and I've been sitting in for Ian Masters. Ian is in Australia for the premiere of a film he made for the BBC in 1968 that was shown once and then destroyed because it was considered too controversial. Fortunately, the movie's director recently discovered a print, and the documentary was reconstructed by the ABC in Australia. It'll be shown for the first time in 45 years at the Sydney Opera House on Thursday night. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. The program is available online at ianmasters.com, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.